Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Passion Talks. I'm Martino, your host, and I'm very happy to welcome you to another episode in English of the podcast. Those of you who know me are aware of how much I value passions and how strongly I believe that having something that we're passionate about is essential for giving meaning and variety to our lives. In fact, in this podcast, we are going to discover the lives and journeys that our guests undertake in the pursuit of happiness and fulfillment, guided by their passions. Here at Passion Talks, in every episode, I'll sit down with people who have taken their interest beyond the realm of hobby and into the realm of cause or life purpose. We chat about what they love doing and share their stories, anecdotes, and lessons that have led them to become the people they are today, trying to discover in the deepest way possible all that is behind their great success. In this episode, I want to welcome Tommaso Ghidini. Tommaso is the head of the Mechanical Engineering Department at the European Space Agency. He also coordinates the European projects of developing 3D printing for space applications, a strategic technology for the forthcoming Moon and Mars missions. After obtaining his PhD in Germany and before joining ESA, Tommaso worked for Airbus on all major civil and military programs of the European aeronautical industry. He has received a number of international awards for major aerospace industrial achievements and developments and is invited to lecture at some of the most prestigious European universities. And lastly, Tommaso is the author of Homo Celestis, a book that he published in 2021 and that recently won the Robinson, a prestigious prize given by one of the main Italian newspapers. The book is a reflection on the relationship humans of the new millennium have and increasingly will have with the cosmos in which we live in, where the sapiens sapiens is ready to become the Homo Celestis. This was a truly eye-opening conversation for me, as we talked about space, a topic that has fascinated humanities for centuries, because at the end of the day, humans are driven to explore the unknown, discover new worlds, and push the boundaries of our scientific and technical limits. And Tommaso, thanks to his experience and mainly his passion for the subject, is able to create a very tangible awareness of such a complex topic. In this conversation, we talked about the future of space exploration, the new Moon and Mars missions, the space economy, the philosophy of exploring the universe, and much more. And now, without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Tommaso Ghidini. Tommaso, it's such a pleasure to be here with you to have this conversation. I've been looking forward to it for quite some time, and doing the research to prepare for it, I realized how incredible is the work you're doing, and it's a pleasure to have you here at Passion Talks.
Thank you so much. Pleasure is mine, and I have to apologize, we didn't make it before, but it's just that the work I'm doing is so intense in the sense that it gets you in, you know, you never get out. And yeah. So finally I'm here and really honored about your interest in talking to me. So go.
Okay, let's do it. And I always like to start by asking how your passions came about. And if I'm not mistaken, two of your biggest ones are flying and the space. Can you share with us how you first got exposed to these two fascinating passions? And did you know from the start that you would have made a career out of them?
Yeah, so first of all, for me, it's not two, it's one. Meaning, okay, flying to me doesn't make any difference with respect to space. It's the same thing in a way, okay? I'm getting to it. The same, the fact is, and this is probably the blessing of a lifetime, I had the blessing to understand it when I was very, very young. That was what changed my life forever. Meaning, at that time, I was 3 years old, incredibly young, but that day is still in my memory completely clear. I have a complete clear picture of what happened. So at that time, it was obviously before the 9/11, 2001. So at that time, you could go into the cockpit in an airline flight. My first flight ever, my father, a medical doctor, said to me, he always tried to make me curious about things. I own him a lot. And then he said to me, Tomas, do you want to see the cockpit? As he said the cockpit, it started in my brain to the awareness raised. Like it was like something very special was about to happen. So I started recording, and I still remember. I remember the face of a lady sitting close to me. I remember the corridor getting you at the cockpit. And then I remember we walked that corridor. In my memory, it looked like we were uphill moving. And then we arrived at the cockpit, and there were a lot of people in front of me. I was very small. There were a lot of people in front of me. I couldn't see. I only saw what then I understood it was the throttle for the engines and an altimeter in the instrument panel. And then my father said, so at that time I had very long hair and very blonde, almost white. I still feel ashamed that my mother obliged me to walk around like this. And there are pictures still available that I tried to destroy because I don't want anybody to see me in that condition. But anyway, the pilot turned and he saw this, let's say, blonde head moving around trying to see what was happening. So he said, give me the blonde kid. And so I felt the hands of the passengers passing me like a pack from one to the other until I arrived to the legs of the pilot, who let me sit on his legs and let me take in my hands the joystick. Now, I can tell you, Martino, it feels still in my hand. That feeling of the joystick is like when you shake the hand of the love of your life. It's something that will never get away as a sensation. That was the blessing that changed my life. After that, I knew it, what I wanted to do. I knew it for sure. And I knew it. There was no other compromise, no other directions, no obstacles, whatever. It was that. That was a blessing to me because, you know, that's a kind of a nuclear engine that is in you, and it doesn't make you feeling tired or disappointed or discouraged. On the contrary, it produces energy, happiness, enthusiasm without generating any nuclear waste, let's say. So it was really a blessing. So after that, I decided to go for it and I went full speed.
We talked a little bit about how you developed this passion for space, but one thing that particularly impressed me of your background is that in your current role, you're also responsible for the failure investigation department. And I'm impressed of this approach to failures and mistakes within space agencies. Can you tell us a bit more about this role and of how you look at this culture of accepting and iterating on mistakes to drive even better innovation?
Yeah, this is you are touching upon a fundamental point. We are actually exploring the unknown. We are leaving the Earth. Imagine no other species of this planet has left the planet. So the Homo sapiens is the one who created for himself the technologies to leave the planet, not only to leave the planet, but then to explore other planets, the Moon, Mars, and all the planets of the solar system, in a robotic manner, not in a human manner, but still we even reached Titan at the border, at the limit of the solar system. So you cannot do missions like that. Like we are going to the sun. We have gone to the sun. We are 40 million kilometers away from the sun in a position that no one else has ever reached. So you cannot think of doing missions of that level, of that complexity, without failures. On the contrary, failure is an indication of the level of innovation you are reaching. Meaning, if you are not innovating, you won't fail. But then it means you are doing something that you are already used to do. And so you are not really changing. You are not creating the next revolution. So failure to me is intrinsic in a way to missions of this level. Of course, you have to manage the risk, meaning we have a budget available where we try new technologies, very new technologies, very innovative technologies. So in that budget is where I want to see a high number of failures. Of course, I'm talking about technologies for unmanned applications. So a failure does not mean we are endangering the life of anybody. It's just failure at the level of a new technology that doesn't work as expected. Okay, at in that budget is where I want to see at least 70% of failures. Why? It's because it tells you that the 30% that remains is really the revolution, is really the innovation. It tells you that you are really pushing the limit. Then on those 30% technologies that make it, there we need to secure them, make them stable, make them reliable, and so making out of them a space mission. The failure investigation role is to me also very crucial once it is applied to a real mission. Because, and a real mission may be a test on ground of an engine, or it can be a launch of a rocket, or it can be a landing on Mars, whatever. There, if you have a failure, if you have the right mindset, first of all, you're open about the failure. You speak about it immediately. You don't hide it. It's very common for human nature to hide about failures, whatever failures are, even if it is a personal failure, even if it is like a personal attitude that is maybe not ideal for a certain context, then you prefer not to speak about it because you see it as a failure.
Like an insecurity. Now, yeah.
Like an insecurity, like something you are ashamed of.
Yep.
In our domain, we change completely the approach. The failure is something that has to be, you have to create a culture, not only in your professional environment, but also maybe in your personal environment, where the failure is something that people can openly talk about. It being an engineering failure, or it being a psychological failure, a personal failure. Just speak about it. And though, if you have this environment, the environment is respectful about the fact that you have the courage to speak about it. And then factually, as the engineering mindset teaches you, you treat it. You treat it as a fact, as something to be solved, not as a policeman to find someone whom will be blamed. That's not failure investigation.
This is nearly the opposite. It's like someone to be celebrated because
exactly. This is stupidity. Like if you want to find the guilty one to, in order to, let's say, mock him, that's stupidity. What we do here is we respect the one who fails, and we are not exposing the one who failed. We expose the misperformance. We expose the issue in order to solve it. And the great, let's say, advantage of this approach is that eventually you learn from the mistake, but not only on that local failure. Out of that, you make new guidelines, you make new standards that apply not only in your engineering environment in which you are working, but also in many other environments. It's not a coincidence that many of the failures we have seen have then influenced the safety of other environments, such as aviation, such as nuclear power plants, medical equipment. So really big impact on our personal life.
Very, very interesting. And do you have any specific like stories or anecdotes of like a failure that maybe eventually turned into either a valuable lesson or a success in the future?
Yeah, I speak about it in the book. I've seen many, of course. And again, failure, you know, you always think of a failure must be something spectacular, like the tragic Challenger explosion or the Columbia, or, you know, a big rocket that explodes. Sometimes failures can also be a ground test. And I was witnessing a very important for us at that time ground test of an engine, and the engine failed. I remember what was for me very, very symbolic, if you want, exemplary of what a failure can be for the professional life and also for the personal life. There was a responsible person, obviously. There was like a coordinator, an engineer, very young, very charismatic, very competent. That was, in a way, as the engine failed, immediately looked at like the one responsible for it. And there I saw Remember, failures always talk about people more than about engineering elements. So I was looking at this person and he had two choices, either starting pointing the fingers to other people, starting saying, "Ah, it's not my fault," or starting minimizing the failure, you know, saying, "I don't know, but this is because of that person didn't do his job," whatever. No. The other option he had was taking leadership. And he did do that. So he immediately said, "It's my fault." Although it wasn't his fault. It was just, you know, a multiple failure of different elements and even different responsibles. That's not the point. He said, "That's my responsibility." But then, and this is the change of paradigm that we need to do, he took the role of, "I want to solve it." So he didn't hide it. He wasn't ashamed of what happened. He just put things on the table and he came with a plan. He came with a plan on what to do to solve the problem and even to verify that the problem has been correctly solved. Now, this person gave a lecture of leadership, of being humble and being protecting of the others. I've never heard him saying a word about persons who were not present. After that, and this is to me, Martino, the real lesson, the problem was solved, the engine worked perfectly, and then it was used on many other programs. And the amazing thing was that the guy has now reached the top level of the company he was in. Why? Because he showed leadership. He showed that he has values that will make the difference in difficult times.
This is a great, great story and very applicable to everyone also outside the realm of space engineering. So thank you very much for sharing. And Tommaso, in a great TED talk you gave, which of course I'm going to link in the description, you talked a lot about how space exploration has led to many technological advancements that of course had a very positive impact on society. And doing more research on your work and preparing for this conversation, I genuinely for the first time realized that of how tangible these benefits are to people's lives here on Earth. But for many, this could seem like a difficult connection to make because it seems so far away from us. Can you comment more on why going to space is crucial for advancements of technology and how it leads to concrete impact on our lives here on Earth?
There is a picture that has been taken by the Apollo 8 astronauts that showed to human beings for the first time the Earth as we never saw before. Meaning, there is a beautiful picture, it's called Earthrise, so the rise of Earth. And I, for people who are interested in, I should strongly recommend to search for it online because it's beautiful. For the first time, three human beings, imagine you are the three astronauts that are flying for the first time out of an orbit of the moon, and you are just approaching the Earth from that distance. So you see the Earth rising on the horizon of the moon, not on the horizon of the Earth. So completely different perspective. Now, the astronaut who took the picture asked for a color photo camera because they had many black and white photo cameras. But he said, this needs to be in color. This is the genius of us human beings that can spot something that a machine would never think of. That picture changed many things on Earth. It became an icon for the ecological, and ambientalist groups that were born at that time, but also against the hunger in the world and also against poverty. All of these groups use that picture as a symbol. Why? Because, and to me, this is probably the biggest gift that the space exploration gave us. It gave us a different consciousness of us all. So space gave us for the first time a view on the beauty, on the fragile, on how fragile the Earth is, but how precious it is for us. It's the only place where we can live. So that to me is this kind of appreciation of the importance of our life on Earth is the great gift that looking at the Earth from space give us. On top of that, it gives us obviously also opportunities. The Earth, like looking at the Earth for space, is the only way we have to monitor in a global manner the 50 variables that dominate the climate change. Imagine, for the first time in human history, 2022 November, together with NASA, we created in here in ESTEC, where I work, we created the first mission to deflect an asteroid. An asteroid that hits the Earth and has a diameter larger than 1 kilometer will cancel from Earth human being, the all human beings, our species completely. And until November last year, we didn't have any weapon to go against it. We could only see it. We could only see it coming. Now, for the first time in our history, we have the weapon to deflect an asteroid that could become the most threatening element ever in our history. And this only thanks to space technology. Then, of course, we also live in space. We have the space station, the International Space Station. Now we are moving the space station towards the moon. So we will build a new space station around the moon. And then we will go back to the moon, this time to stay on it. Okay, all of this gives us technologies that otherwise we would never have. Why? Because us human beings are not born to stay in space. And so we need to have technologies against radiation, against some of the issues we have, like osteoporosis, like cardiovascular disease, and so, to live in space. We can bring them back to Earth and have them available. Imagine the CT scan, so the computer tomography that you use in the hospitals when you go for do a check, a diagnosis, or also to guide a surgical intervention. All of this technology comes from the Apollo mission. It's a patent of the Apollo mission. The microprocessor is a patent from the Apollo mission. Imagine the microprocessor, I mean, is everywhere. We had a mission, it's called Rosetta. We landed on a comet. Because the comet was so distant from us, we had to develop technologies in order to navigate close to the comet in a completely automatic manner. So we had photo cameras, digital photo cameras. The first ones were developed back then. And then we took them, make them small, make them light, increase the computing power and speed, and increase the storing power. The patents developed for that mission are the basis of the patents supporting the photo cameras of our mobile phones. Now tell me, who doesn't use a photo camera of the mobile phone nowadays? On top, we also had telecommunication missions to support. The interview we are doing now is thanks to a telecommunication system that comes from satellites. We passed through a pandemic thanks to space technologies, keeping working, keeping having our kids at school despite they were at home, and keeping nurturing our interpersonal relationships. All of them was possible thanks to space technology. Otherwise, we couldn't make it.
Yeah, because sometimes it seems so far, so intangible, but we use it on a daily basis. Also, when you look at the forecast, the weather forecast.
All the time. The navigation system, if you want to go and visit a friend, it comes from a satellite. If you want to, like, monitor and control and have precise information on a global manner on the 50 variables of the climate change, there's only one way you can do it, and you do it thanks to satellites from space.
Well, this is pretty exciting. And another interesting and crucial technology in the space field is 3D printing. You talked a lot about the importance of these technologies, and you're a specialist on this topic, as you coordinate the European project of developing 3D printing for space applications. Can you please talk about why you think these technologies are so strategic for the future of space exploration?
Yeah, you said it all, strategic. For us, additive manufacturing, 3D printing, is what we call strategic or also enabling technology, meaning is a technology without which you could not do some of the missions we do. Like, for example, Now we want to go back to the moon. This time, if in the 1969 we went to the moon to be there, to be on the moon, now we go to the moon to stay on the moon. Like to, we try to extend our permanence on the moon. Now, if you want to do that, eventually you will need to have a moon base. So you will have to have a settlement, stable settlement. You have to build it. If you think of a traditional manufacturing of a house on the moon, you would need to send to the moon materials, tools, personnel, which is from a technological, economical, and logistical point of view, impossible to do. Now, today we couldn't make it. Unless we do something completely different. That is, you use the dust that is already on the moon regolith, you send a 3D printer to the moon, and the 3D printer using the sun that is on the moon, for example, South Pole permanent, you continuously have sunlight, then you print and you bake layer by layer the moon base. We have done it already. We have a 1.5 tons demonstrator of a moon base 3D printed using the sun as a source of energy and the dust of the moon surface as a material. So this tells you a completely different approach that is in situ resource utilization. So you use the resources that are locally. If you think further, for example, a mission to Mars, there is even more evident because the mission to Mars will be, as I call it, we will cut the umbilical cord with the Earth. So their sustainability and independence is the world, is what you need to achieve. So imagine you are with a rover on Mars and one wheel fails. Not only you have to have the spare part, but you also have to have the tools capable of removing the damaged wheel that maybe is so damaged and so bent that you cannot even extract it anymore. And this is the difference between life and death. So instead of having with you all the possible spare parts that maybe will fail or maybe will never fail, and all the possible tools for all the happenings that could occur on Mars, instead of having that, you just bring with you a 3D printer, and from the Earth, whatever happens, they will send you a drawing of what you need to have to solve that situation. It's like a kind of a teletransportation, like Star Trek. Instead of sending the part, you send the drawings and you print the part on the planet. That is why additive manufacturing is so revolutionary for planetary and space exploration.
And Tommaso, going back to the 3D printing on the moon, I guess that from a very economical perspective and also strategic, you're trying to build maximum efficiency with minimum cost and resources to 3D print the moon base. What, just for my curiosity, what shape did you end up deciding for the moon base?
Yeah, so this is a very important question. Actually, we did a trade-off, which is we weren't sure. I mean, it's not that we said, it's so cool 3D printing, let's use it there. No, we said, okay, in the scenario we want to build the moon base, what is the best approach we can use? We bring the material from the Earth, one approach. We dig and we actually build the moon base under the surface. We use the lava tubes that are already present on the moon. There are big tunnels in the subsurface of the moon, or we use 3D printing. Well, the trade-off we did showed that the most economical, logistical, and technical suitable, the more suitable of those solutions was the 3D printing on the moon. And the shape is very interesting because we learn from the bees, meaning Mother Nature teaches us on everything. And it particularly, it teaches us on how to adapt to Mother Nature itself. Like Mother Nature creates human beings or living beings that are capable to adapt to human nature thanks to human nature technologies or solutions. That's for me, is fascinating. So turns out that the bees builds the honeycomb, so their structure, their home, in the most efficient manner from a manufacturing perspective and from a structural perspective.
Amazing.
So we use the honeycomb of the bees as the structure to build the moon base on the moon, because that's the most effective in terms of structural and manufacturing usage.
Wow. I didn't expect that, but wow, this is fascinating.
And funny enough, very, very elegantly as well, if you do that by using the, let's say, the resources that are already on the moon, the regolith, and you build the honeycomb as the bees do around the astronauts, at the same time, you protect them, because at the end, this concrete wall is really a concrete, yep, multimeters, is 2 meters section wall. So if you think the astronauts will be on the other side of the wall, you will protect them from the micrometeoroids that the moon, not having the atmosphere, is continuously bombarded with. And second, you protect them from the radiations that the moon will see very much, because it's outside the magnetosphere of the Earth and is then without atmosphere. So the radiations are very high. On top of that, because we want to build the moon base on the South Pole where there is water, we want to put between the wall and the living room of the moon base a wall of water, which will further protect the astronauts from the radiation. So as you see, it's a very nice way of using the resources locally, but also a very, very elegant way of protecting the astronauts from the major threats on the planet. By the way, it's the same thing that Cristoforo Colombo did when he went to the US, to America. He did not bring the houses from Europe. He built the new world by using the resources that he found there.
Yep.
This is exactly what we are doing on Mars and on the moon.
I didn't expect that answer, and it's very fascinating. And the 3D printing is indeed, as you said and perfectly explained, a crucial technology for the future of space exploration. But another technological trend that I wanted your view on is artificial intelligence, because it's almost needless to say that OpenAI, ChatGPT are currently the very hot topics on the internet. And when I talk to my friends, it always comes up. So I wanted to ask you if AI played a big role in space exploration up till now, and do you think it will be incrementally more relevant in the future?
So AI is a crucial aspect, is another fundamental aspect on many applications. But first of all, in my role doing engineering, artificial intelligence gives us a unique opportunity to have big data analysis, so we can see how a design is going. We can do digital twins of real structures, go on virtual testing instead of doing a real testing, and so having, you know, an understanding of what is happening before we design it, before we do it, we do really optimized design, optimized testing. Okay, this is, if you want, on the engineering side. But on the pure exploration and support to astronaut side, also there, the advantage is enormous. And the applications for AI is enormous. For example, we have a robot on the space station called Simon that has a face recognition software. He learns from you. He actually got trained with you, say, or in that case, with our commander of the space station. And so he keeps looking at your face in your moments during your life, day to day, and he gets trained. Now, he doesn't only recognizes your face and he follows you, because he can fly on the space station. So he floats on the space station, and he follows you continually, but he also understands your psychological moments. So he talks to you in a way and in a fashion that is supporting for your particular psychological conditions. This we do because the flight to Mars will be extremely dangerous in psychological terms. So we want to have robotic assistance in terms of workload, say, offload, and second, in terms of psychological support to the team. Like, we want the artificial intelligence to understand how the team dynamics is going and then intervene in trying to solve the psychological issues. Psychology would be the big term. The other option we have with artificial intelligence, this I saw in a research center which really shocked me. They did something very special. They gave the complete production of Frank Zappa in terms of music, in terms of shows, in terms of videos, everything which Frank Zappa has produced. They gave it to a crunching of this artificial intelligence tool. Now, the artificial intelligence tool understood who Frank Zappa is. And now that artificial intelligence is writing songs that Frank Zappa has never written, but that are plausible with respect to the Frank Zappa, let's say,
style,
artistic production.
Okay. Okay.
Then what was really mind-blowing is that you see then an hologram of Frank Zappa, real life, that sings and dances a song that he never wrote, in a way that is completely natural with respect to Frank Zappa's style. Now, Martino, if you think of Mars exploration will be very crucial, very critical, because we will have the famous 40 minutes delay, meaning because of the distance of Mars, you cannot make a phone call with your wife or husband or partner, but there is a 40 minutes delay. Imagine how irritated we become when WhatsApp has a 1 second, 2 seconds delay. Here we are talking about 40 minutes. So obviously a conversation live is not possible. So what we could think of is to have a clone of your loved ones coming with you and respond to you, not in a video mode, but in a real life mode, because that artificial intelligence would adapt to the situation and would play in a realistic and plausible manner your loved ones.
With an hologram.
Yes. At the same time, you could leave an hologram of yourself on Earth. So the astronaut could leave himself on Earth. Now, take it through. Imagine that means that we can have an hologram of ourselves who could transmit our personality to our future generations, which we will never meet. Unfortunately, I never met my grandfather, none of them, my grandfather from my mother, neither my grandfather from my father. Imagine if they had left an avatar of themselves, which has been trained by their, what, of course they didn't have it, but Facebook, Instagram, all the video productions we produce anyway on Earth, they could learn out of it, understand what your personality is, and today I could at least interact with them and at least know what kind of persons they were.
This is amazing. Yeah, because often I like my grandfather passed away when I was 5 years old, so I basically never met him as an adult. And you always hear you had to meet him. He was the best person ever, or he was super funny.
Exactly.
Now we can exactly get to that. We can have a more tangible way of getting to that. Wow, this is mind blowing.
Exactly, and of course this is something that ethically speaking needs to be controlled.
Absolutely.
Because it can also take a turn in a negative direction. But I'm a scientist, I'm an optimist by nature. So I only think about how beautiful it could be to know my grandfather, although I never met him. Yeah. How beautiful it could be that my grandchildren would know what I was, not what I did, not what I left, what I was, in terms of personality, in terms of ambitions, of passion, of love. That would be a great leftover.
Yep. Wow. Yeah, we can get into a very philosophical conversation with this topic.
Absolutely, but space
It's philosophy. Yeah, you always talk about it also in your book. But very, very interesting what you talked about, honestly. And you talked about the complexity of going to Mars from a psychological point of view. But for now, I want to do a step back, because, of course, Mars, it's in the radar. We're going to get into that. But the first milestone, and correct me if I'm wrong, is going to the moon. And you talked about it with also the 3D printing technology. My question is, maybe a bit basic, but I wanted to understand why the moon. Why is it important that we first go to the moon? What are we trying to get out of this mission? Like the Artemis is one of the big ones of the moon. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So first of all, you said it right from the beginning. The moon is not only the moon. The moon is to be seen in the context on the moon and then Mars. So why are we back to the moon? Well, John Fitzgerald Kennedy said, we go to the moon because it's there, because we are explorers. That's the first, if you want, strong push that we as human beings have. We want to know what is on the moon just because we can go there, and so we go. It's a pure, intellectual curiosity. On top of that, now, he said that in the 60s, now things have evolved. Now we know that we can go to the moon for many other reasons, on top of the pure scientific and exploratory curiosity. We want to go there because on the moon there are materials. There is titanium, there is platinum, there is helium-3, which is an ideal fuel for the nuclear fusion. There is so much that we could bring it back to Earth and, solve completely the electrical problem on Earth by using that as a resource. Bear in mind that the resources on the Earth are limited, and we are growing as a species, which is good, but we are consuming much more resources. If we want to electrify the Earth, which I think it's a very good step to take for climate change, but then we should not dream. We need to remain factual. I'm an engineer. So where are the resources coming from? So we are actually moving from a dependency on fuel, fossil fuel, to a dependency from materials. There are materials for the batteries, materials for the electrical cables, materials for the processors, and those are limited. The moon and the asteroids can become a resource for materials. Second, the moon offers unique scientific opportunities because you don't have atmospheric filters, so you can observe space with radio telescopes, which are very performing. It's like having a super satellite at 300,000 kilometers from the Earth, so not disturbed by the Earth the luminosity and by the atmosphere, and so you can observe space. On top of that, and this is very, very important, and there is where Mars plays a role, the Moon becomes an ideal planetary representative test environment where we could test all the technologies that we will use and the logistics and the procedure, the operational aspects for astronauts that we will use for the flight to Mars. But we will test it in a very representative planetary environment, though without the dangers or with the limited danger, in case something happens to the astronauts, we can bring them back home very quickly. So the moon becomes a very interesting, test center for testing all what we will need to go to Mars. And last but not least, very important now, the moon becomes a touristic attraction. It has never been. Like, imagine us now, the Homo sapiens, has created the technology to go on a vacation to the moon. Of course, I'm not talking about tomorrow, but Elon Musk is already selling tickets for an orbital flight around the moon and back. If one day we could even think about astronauts going on the moon surface, would you not go? I mean, Martino, if they would tell you, okay, the plane ticket, the flight ticket would be, I don't know, say a high number, high value, 20,000, 30,000 euros, provided that you have them with margins on the bank, would you not go? I would go.
100%, no brainer. I would go 100%.
No brainer. Yeah. So what the beauty of this era, we are living in an unprecedented era, Martino, here, in my opinion, with respect to space. We are living what aviation was living at its dawn, when the aviation started. Now we are seeing exactly the same on space. At the beginning, people are saying, now just the rich, now just Elon Musk, now just Jeff Bezos, Sir Richard Branson can fly to space. And they say that in the negative terms. I see it as a very positive thing, because I see this, yes, not only the richest on the planet, but is exactly what happened in aviation. In aviation, only the richest at that time could fly. Now we have low-cost airliners. I expect we will see low-cost flying on the moon, to the moon. I'm not saying tomorrow. I'm saying if we keep working at the pace we are, I'm sure we will have a low-cost company flying around the moon. Would you not go?
Yeah.
I would go immediately.
In our generation, you think?
It could be. Okay. It could be. If people like Elon Musk, and this is where I'm thankful to people like this, because they started it. If we keep at that pace, I am still confident. I have a passion for flying. I have a passion for space. And as I told you, they are the same. I'm still hopeful to maybe have the chance in my lifetime, and I'm much older than you, to see, to leave a flight in space, commercially speaking.
Okay, we talked about the moon, but when it comes to going to Mars, apart from the 7 months that it takes to get to Mars, it seems to me there's also a complexity from a very concrete point of view, and talking about the orbits of the planets, there's sort of a window where we can go, where the length.
Yeah, sorry for interrupting you.
No.
First of all, Mars is a difficult planet. It's a difficult planet for different reasons. If you think that 50% of the spacecraft that has been launched towards Mars from all the world, not just NASA, not just ESA, from all the space agencies have failed, 50%. So it's a difficult planet. Yes, there is a window, because there are moments in which Mars is close to the Earth, and there are moments in which you have planetary issues. What is important to understand is, if you think about going there with people, you have three main challenges. First, radiation. Second, propulsion. Third, power. So you need to protect the astronauts from the radiation level that they will be hit during the world flight and during the permanence. Second, you have to fly through the asteroid ring. So you have to have propulsion to get to Mars and throttable engines to land on Mars. Third, you need to have power, electrical power. Mars is so distant from the sun that the electrical power you can generate with solar arrays is very limited. And on top, there are continuous sand storms on the surface. So you can pollute, hence reduce the efficiency of your solar panels. So all of this has to be solved. First, propulsion and power. I don't think we can think of going to Mars with people without having a nuclear power and nuclear propulsion systems. That's why we are working on them. And third, radiation, you need to protect the astronauts. All of this is from a technological point of view. But there is a much more subtle and even more insidious aspect, that is the psychology of the astronauts going there. I mean, you have to think that these people will leave the Earth for years. We have done no one has ever lost sight of the Earth. We have never had a flight in which the astronauts lost the view on Earth. You will lose the view on Earth. You will lose the contact with nature. We have done a test. We have put six analog astronauts in what we call Mars 500 test, meaning we put them into a spacecraft simulator, like plausible spacecraft as the one which will fly to Mars. And we left them there for 500 days, completely isolated. So to try to understand what happens in a crew that goes on such a mission. And we saw things that are incredible. But first of all, the 40 minutes delay is the most disturbing thing. Hence, we will operate the mission in a way that they will be kept occupied as they are talking to with a 40 minutes delay. We will make it such that the tasks they are doing will dilute the time in a way that for them, they will be occupied in those 40 minutes in which they are waiting for an answer. And then the answer will come, and then they will have another task to do, and which will keep them occupied. So you will dilute so much the time that for them it would seem as the communication was live, but it wouldn't be. Then you have to keep them with three main things: responsibility, occupation, and purpose. In that flight, they need to keep feeling they are responsible of something very important. They have to feel occupied, and they have to have a sense of purpose. If you lose these three elements, they will get into the boredom. And if you get into the boredom, then two things can happen: either aggressive or depressive behavior. And this is what you want to avoid. That's why we will help them with gaming, with nature. Nature is something that we need to leave. If you think about you, for example, you maybe, or me, you are in a small apartment, in a small office, whatever it is, you have a plant, you have a flower. Why? Because our DNA calls for it. Therefore, we will create with artificial intelligence, say with augmented reality and artificial reality, we will create not only familiar environment, but also earth-like environment. Like, we will have them exploring the Alps. We will have them walking on the beach. So all of this will be with augmented reality.
A nice walk in nature. Yeah.
A nice walk, yeah. And then we will have the Frank Zappa approach. So this kind of avatar support and robotic support to try to mitigate the psychological effects.
I think we had a great conversation about space exploration, but another topic that it's really growing in the last years is the space economy, which is driven by strategic interest from governments combined with technological innovations, as you said, opening up new markets for the private sector. We're seeing the space race of Elon Musk, Branson, Jeff Bezos. I read an article that if we had to estimate a forecast of this market in the coming decades, Citigroup predicts that the space industry could reach $1 trillion in annual revenue in only 20 years. What do you think are the most promising areas of this new space economy?
So I have no doubt that the space economy is booming already. And I have no doubt that it will accelerate even further. So the more you accelerate, the more activities then can be generated. So it's a auto-fertilizing environment. Space economy, first of all, what does it mean? Space economy, as you said, is using space to create economical value, to create commercial values. In the past, we were going to space as agencies, so it was just an investment. Now it can also bring money back to many companies. How? Well, first of all, the direct utilization of space. Like, for example, you have from space, as I said at the beginning, you have an ideal observatory on Earth. That observatory creates images, creates data, creates information. You can use that information and sell those information as products. For example, you can guide agricultural, precision agricultural activities. So you can tell farmers when humidity is there. You can tell farmers what temperature the fields are. You can tell farmers where to put the crop and how to maintain them. Or you can monitor the ships. You can provide information to governments to see how safe the schools, the bridges, the dams are, and so you can make a profit out of all this information. On top, you can generate technologies as a return out, spin-off technologies. For example, we had a satellite called Proba V, which was monitoring the vegetation all over the world. The camera that was used to monitor the vegetation, that camera was then transformed into a camera for a microscope that you can use on medical, on an hospital to check for cancer of skin much earlier than normally. Producing this kind of cameras and selling it or selling the service creates value. And this is what we have as a business incubator centers, meaning we have technologies from space that we apply into non-space environment and we make money out of it. Not we agency, but we community. So people, Everybody can do it. Brembo, for example, now just to mention a name, the company that does the brakes, those brakes are done for high-performing cars. Those brakes are done with a material that has been developed for one of our re-entry vehicles. That material is patented. The patent was used by a company to create a product that is not space-related, but comes from space in a way. That's another way of seeing space economy. The other way is, for example, on the moon exploration, there will be company that will provide services to the space agencies or to other companies, medical companies to do research in space, pure scientific activities to do research in space. How? Well, for example, selling time of orbiting vehicles and do experiments around the Earth or doing observations. Selling services to bring a spacecraft, grab a spacecraft and bring it to the moon or bring it to another orbit. Selling activities on the moon to do research, to do more and more, even at some point, touristic exploration of the moon. All of this is part of the space economy and the use of space for commercial interests.
And then, as you said, as your second example of why the moon is important, there's also the space mining opportunity of landing on asteroids to get rare earth.
An asteroid. If you think there are asteroids that are just made of gold.
Yeah, exactly.
Or asteroids that are just made of platinum. Wow. We are talking about hundreds of thousands of tons. Obviously, you could say, yeah, but I have to go there, bring it back. And so, yes, absolutely. But this is what we are trying to achieve. We are trying to get to a level of technologies cheap, sustainable, that can make us sustainably mining instead of in Central Africa, which eventually would finish, on an asteroid and then bring it back to Earth. This is not science fiction. We are working on it.
Yeah. I mean, we saw it with the Psyche 16. Is it it's a gold mine asteroid full of crazy amount of value of platinum, gold,
yes,
rare earth?
Absolutely. And people are now saying we could use the asteroid even to fuel the missions to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
Like you can use the asteroid to provide you with the fuel or resources, water, for the astronauts to drink, and then oxygen for the astronaut to breathe. So, you know, they are unlimited resources. Space is an unlimited resources for humanity. But we need to be able to profit out of this resource. And I'm very honored to be part of an agency that has a program and an office that is called Planetary Protection. That is, yes, we can use the resources of space. Yes, we can, let's say, explore and commercially use space, but in a respectful manner. So we want to protect that asset that space is.
Yeah, Tomas, I would stay here literally all day to ask you questions because it's every answer is even more interesting. So I wanted to wrap up our conversation with a couple of more philosophical questions because, as you said, space is philosophy. And I wanted to ask how your career in space exploration has impacted your understanding of our place as human beings in the universe.
Completely. I think I'm grateful for what I have the opportunity to do as a job. It's not a job, it's a mission. I don't go on holiday, but not that, I mean, I don't want to seem the hero who just, you know, is saying I'm not going on holiday. It's that I go on holiday, but even when I'm on holiday, I'm thinking about what I'm doing. And it's not a burden, is not a heavy thing. On the contrary, is so inspiring and is so elevated as a mission for all of us that it's not heavy. And I keep, for example, I will not see most probably the Mars mission, the Mars base. I will not probably see in my lifespan, I will not probably see a settlement on Mars. But that does not mean that I'm working day and night for it. So that is the, you know, how compelling this environment is. So if you think about that, this is then giving why space is so relevant for human beings. It's because it gives us answer. It gives us answer to the most compelling philosophical questions we have. Like, where are we coming from? Where did it all start? Where are we going? Is there life somewhere else in the universe? All of these questions, they can get you awake. They can keep you awake. And this is why space is so appealing to me, at least, because there we find answers.
And in your book, Homo Celestis, you talk a lot about this, and you argue that space exploration is not just about scientific discovery, but also about the survival of the human species, as the Earth resources are finite. And the planet is facing, as we all know, the impact of climate change. Do you think that us becoming a multiplanetary species is the only way for the continuation of human civilization in the long term?
No, that is a very, very delicate question. First of all, I'd like to pass a clear message. We are not going to space because we consider the Earth dead.
Okay.
Or because we are looking for planet B. Not at all. We are going to space because, as I was saying, space is giving us answer also on how to protect the Earth. So we are going to space to better live on our planet, to better understand what are the threats to our planet, what are the current sicknesses of our planet, and then trying to solve them from a space perspective. So thanks to the space asset. By doing that, though, we see how resourceful space is and how we could become, in fact, indeed, a multiplanetary species. So it's the other way around, if you want. So we got to space to protect our planet. That is the only one we have, and it's the one we need to treasure. But second, by going elsewhere, we see if we could live elsewhere as well.
Okay.
And this is, to me, a resource and an opportunity that we need to maximize, because getting a multiplanetary species is a philosophical, is an ideological step more than anything else. And we need to get used to it. We need to start thinking not anymore in terms of continental flights. We need to start thinking in terms of interplanetary flights, because this is what we can do. It's just a matter of entering in that mindset. Like, if you stop at an airport, say, where are you now? In Madrid.
You said. Yep.
Yeah. So go to the Madrid airport and ask the people coming out of the airport, why did you come to Madrid? How many answers will you get? Thousands. What is the right one? Everyone. Because it's a personal motivation. One came to see a friend work. One came to see Madrid. One came to see, I don't know, a show, whatever. All of them are right, because our personal motivation. We need to find personal motivation to go to Mars, because we can, but it's now switching the mindset.
It's always starting with the why. What's our purpose? What's our vision? If you don't have that, you don't have the fuel to make it happen. And it's a bit of a trend of our conversation as well.
Yeah. So Italo Calvino, probably one of the most genius writers in Italy, was, and probably in the world, he said that you are going to a new town because that town brings an answer to a question you didn't know you had. So that's the reason why we should go to Mars. And with that approach, we should go to Mars.
Yeah. Well, Tommaso, it was such a great conversation for me. I will re-listen to it I don't know how many times, not only in the editing phase, but also...
For me as well, Martino. Really a pleasure talking to you, and very stimulating discussion. Thanks for that.
No, thank you. Thank you, Tommaso. I don't know if there's any final messages. I know that the future generations are a bit overwhelmed by, you open the media and they talk about the future in very pessimistic terms. I don't know if there's any like final message you want to send to get that hope back and that like mindset of never always push for your dreams.
Yeah, no, for sure. To the young generations, I mean, really, this is their time. I didn't see ever an era like this one. We are bringing our values, our culture, our loves even to another planet to stay. And to do it, for doing so, we need to do it in peace. And that decision to do it in peace is for the next generations. We have now the technologies available. It's now for them to achieve that goal in a peaceful manner and in a respectful manner for the planet we are visiting and in an inclusive manner. I mean, this kind of diversity, drama, tragedy we are living on Earth. I mean, here we are talking about, if you think about a human being born on Mars, and eventually we may even have that. That person will adapt to a new planet. It will not only be different in terms of skin or sexual orientation or political orientation. This is just ridiculous. It will be completely different, even from a body perspective, from a body point of view. It's like the Neanderthal was living close to the Homo sapiens. This is the beauty of life, that is adapting to an environment to give us new hope. And this is what our life is about.
Perfect way to finish the conversation, Tommaso. I can't wait to come to Amsterdam and maybe...
We will meet. You will come and see Isa so that we can show you what we do.
Oh my God, this is music to my ears. I cannot wait. Thank you so much. And
you're welcome.
It's been a great conversation.
Thank you, Martina. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Passion Talks. I hope you enjoyed it, and I really do appreciate you taking the time to listen all the way through. If you found value in this conversation, the best way to support this podcast is to leave a review, share it with friends, or share it on social media. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your support. And please contact me directly on Instagram or LinkedIn if you have any feedback or ideas to improve the content of the podcast. Thank you, and see you again in the next episode.